I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of Jean Bartik and the other women who helped program one of the world's very first computers. It was called the ENIAC, and in 1945, men and women worked shoulder to shoulder designing, programming, and testing a computer that literally filled a room. Jean Bartik wrote a poem about that time at the University of Pennsylvania.
There once was a congenial spot where ideas flowed so freely and designs were done so speedily, where all of them forgot, frontiers weren't pierced so easily.
When the history of those days was written, though, the women programmers, they were called human computers, the women didn't get the same credit that the men did. Hardware outranked software. So we'll take a trip in the story's Wayback Machine to meet the women who played such a key role in those punch card days. That's coming up right after the news. Yesterday in San Francisco, Apple released its new small computer. They call it the MacBook Air. It's a notebook with a high-speed processor, a backlit screen, and an 80-gigabyte hard drive, and it's 3/4 inch thick, no wider than your thumb. Oh, and it weighs 3 pounds. So I'm reading about this new MacBook Air and thinking about the way that Jean Bartik described the ENIAC, one of the world's first computers, back in 1945.
Well, it's about 80 feet long. It was on four sides of a big room, and it was 9 feet high, and it was about a foot deep. And then it had almost 18,000 vacuum tubes.
Those blinking, flashing, and whirring racks of hardware were a source of wonder in the mid-40s.
Every instrument in this room is constantly monitoring, testing, pulse-taking, controlling. To it come continuous streams of data, which it continuously absorbs and stores.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
At the start of the Second World War, Jean Bartik was a farm girl in rural Missouri. She was an absolute whiz at math and science. So naturally, when Jean went on to Missouri Teachers College, she majored in math. She says that put her immediately into a minority.
I was the only math major in my class, and when we got the Navy program, most of my math courses I took with sailors. I was the only woman and, of course, the only civilian, so all the sailors knew me.
Tell me something, though. If you were a math whiz back in 44 and 45 in college, I mean, today people talk about the fact that there are more men than women who are drawn to math. Was it even more so the case when you were in school?
Absolutely. It was quite unusual. I didn't want to teach school. I come from a long line of school teachers. So I had said to my calculus teacher, I didn't want to teach school, but I didn't know what else I could do. So she began bringing me letters of recruitment from various things. And one of the letters was from Aberdeen Proving Ground. And they were looking for human computers to compute trajectories that go into the firing tables for the new guns that were being developed during World War II.
Gene, I need to stop you there. You said human computers. We never think of people being called computers today. What was a human computer in 1945?
A human computer was a human being who did calculations using a hand calculator like a Moreau, Marchant, or Frieden. As a matter of fact...
No, wait a second. I need to stop you again, because the hand calculator you're talking about, it isn't anything like we think of as a hand calculator.
Oh, no, certainly not. I mean, you did multiplication by a series of additions. It was more complex than an adding machine, but very much like an adding machine.
And why did they need computers at an ordnance place? The Aberdeen Proving Ground was where they tested weapons. Why did they need computers there?
Well, there are a lot of reasons for it. These firing tables were used by the soldiers when they went out in the field to see what angle of elevation to set the gun to reach a distant target. There are a lot of factors that affect how far the shell travels, and the biggest one is the drag of the air on the shell. As the shell moves along, it pushes air in front of it. And the faster the shell goes, the more air is pushed in front of it. Now, this continues until it reaches the speed of sound. And when that happens, all hell breaks loose, and the shell wiggles and waggles. Well, they call it yawing. And then when you are past the speed of sound, the air streams along the side of the shell, and it becomes, the drag is much, much less.
So, Gene, are you telling me that there are mathematical equations and calculations that will allow you to factor in everything from, you know, the temperature of the air to the speed of the wind to all that stuff? So, you know, you could say to someone launching a missile, you know, here are your coordinates, here's the setting you need, and you'll be right on.
That's exactly what we did, and that's why they did the measurements. Firing table took about 1,000 trajectories. Now, computer.
I was going to say each one of these things had to be worked out by a human computer.
Yeah, and a human computer took about 30 to 40 hours to calculate one trajectory.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. And I'm no whiz at math, but even I can figure out that if it takes 30 to 40 hours to calculate one trajectory and a gunner needs 1,000 trajectories for a single firing table, then it's clear why the Aberdeen Proving Ground would want a math whiz like Gene Bartik. We also need to remember that late in World War II, most young men were fighting overseas, so it was a time when bright young women could make their way into and up in the workforce. Jean got a telegram with her invitation to start work at Aberdeen, and she was on the train to Philadelphia the next morning.
I came there for $2,000 a year plus $400 for working Saturdays. And my title was computer, and the rank, the government ranking was SP6, which is sub-professional 6. They did not give women professional titles at this time by Aberdeen. Even if a woman were a PhD math major, she would still be a sub-professional.
Was it fun living in Philadelphia?
Gee, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. there were about 5 young women who were recruited the same time I was. 2 were from Kansas, and 1 was from Ohio, and 1 was from Wisconsin, and I was from Missouri. So the 5 of us used to spend Sundays running around seeing Philadelphia, and then all the people that I worked with were brilliant. In fact, I thought everybody in Philadelphia was brilliant. I thought, gee, what a wonderful place.
Jean told me that she was a farm girl who'd never wanted to be a farmer's wife. She'd read a lot of books. She wanted adventure, and she got it. Just a couple of months after Jean moved to Philadelphia, a notice went round saying that the Moore School at the University of Pennsylvania was hiring women to help run a new computer called the ENIAC. Jean knew an opportunity when she spotted one.
They said they were looking for 5 people. I didn't know, but they'd already hired 4, so they're really only looking for 1. So 13 of us applied, and I was not selected. I was the second alternate, so I was very surprised on a Friday afternoon when my manager called me in and asked me if I could be ready to go to Aberdeen on Monday to learn punch card equipment, because the ENIAC used card reader as input and a card punch as output and a tabulator as its printer. So the ENIAC programmers had to go to Aberdeen to learn punch card equipment, and I had been selected. Well, what happened was that the first person selected had a very nice apartment in Philadelphia. Aberdeen was pretty much of a hellhole. It's about 32,000 acres of swamp, and they had 20,000 soldiers there. So she didn't want to go give it up and go to that hellhole Aberdeen. So she turned him down. Well, the first alternate was away on vacation, and during World War II, you practically never got a vacation, but she happened to be on one, so they called her up and told her she'd have to come back to go to Aberdeen and give up her vacation, and she decided she didn't want to do that. So I thought it was wonderful. So,
did you have any idea what you were going to Aberdeen to do? Did you know that you were going to be working on, you know, the state-of-the-art computer of that time?
Oh, yeah, we knew that was new. Yeah, we were very excited.
One trouble was that the system set in place to clear soldiers, or men, to work on such top-secret projects were not in place for the women who were hired.
See, our security clearance hadn't come through, so they didn't let us see the ENIAC. We didn't see the ENIAC till we were picked in June. We didn't see the ENIAC till October.
Wait a second. Hold on. I need to stop you there. You'd gone there to work on the ENIAC. What do you mean you weren't even allowed to see it?
No. Well, when we came back from Aberdeen, they didn't even have an office or a place for us to sit. We just had to scrounge around space. Betty Snyder and I just picked a classroom because students weren't there in August, and they gave us these big block diagrams of the ENIAC and told us to study them.
But they wouldn't let you look at the actual computer itself.
Well, yeah, isn't that silly? We could see the diagrams of it, but we couldn't see it.
Gene Bartik recalls that it was a chance encounter with the man who'd invented the ENIAC computer, a professor, John W. Mockley, that gave the women the insight they needed to get started.
We didn't know anything about reading these block diagrams, so we were sitting there trying to figure out how an accumulator worked, and all of a sudden, this man walked in the room and looked all around at the ceiling. Well, the reason he was doing that was that they were putting a third floor on the Moore School where we were sitting, and the jackhammers were going, and this dust was flying, and it was hot. So he looked all around, and he said, well, I'm just checking to see if the ceiling's falling in. So he came over, and he said, hi, my name is John Mockley. Well, we almost fell off our chairs because we'd never even seen Professor John.
Well, he was the guy in charge of the whole project, right?
Well, they were the inventors, yes. So we said, boy, are we glad to see you. So we began to ask him questions. So he had an office next door. So he said to us, well, anytime I'm in my office and you have questions, you can come in and ask me the questions. So what we did was save up our questions till the afternoon when he would be in his office, and then we'd go in and ask him our questions. So basically, we learned the ENIAC from the backside out, and that's a good thing, actually, because when we finally began to program the ENIAC, we not only knew how it worked from the front, but we knew how it worked from the back because we had studied these block diagrams.
Gene Bartik and the other human computers did the programming, and they were there to see the machine actually come to life. I'll talk more with Gene about her moment in technical Camelot in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Even though World War II ended in 1945, many of the technical projects that had started during the war were just picking up speed. At the head of that pack was the computer. Gene Bartik had been a math whiz at high school and in college, and in the rush to get the best brains working on these projects, Gene and five other women were brought to the University of Pennsylvania to program the new ENIAC computer. The only thing was that they couldn't even get the security clearance they needed to work on the computer itself. Gene says the five single women took advantage of their time together.
We were crazy about each other, and we were interesting because one was a Quaker and one was a Catholic, two were Jewish, and I belonged to the Church of Christ, so and a farmer, and they were all fascinated by me because I hadn't been anywhere or done anything, and they tried to fulfill all my fantasies for me. I had always dreamed of eating lobster. So they took me to Baltimore. And then the girl from New York, she took me one weekend to New York. We got right off the train, and she took me over to the brass rail. And I put my foot on the brass rail and had a drink. And then we went over to Radio City Music Hall. and saw the show when the stage comes up and the orchestra is playing, and she was leaning in front of me to see my face. And so then we took the subway to Far Rockaway.
And what was it like being a single woman with a bunch of other single women, you know, gallivanting around the East Coast and in the middle of 1945? Were there soldiers and sailors around? Were you all on your own? What was going on?
Well, when we were in Aberdeen, there were 20,000 sailors, and I don't know why. I mean, soldiers. I mean, they whistled and carried on, but I mean, it's pretty boring, and we weren't interested in them. Well, actually, Ruth met a Marine sergeant, and I met an Army sergeant, so we double-dated all that summer, going to the non-commissioned officers' club.
In the fall of 1945, engineers from Los Alamos came to Philadelphia to test the ENIAC computer. And that's when Gene Bartik and the other programmers saw the machine for the first time.
We were all assigned a unit, and Herman Goldstein, who was a liaison with Aberdeen, stood out the middle, and then he would, like an orchestra conductor, and he would say, accumulator one, set switch one to alpha, stuff like that.
How big was this computer, Gene? I don't even have a mental picture of it.
Well, it's about 80 feet long. It was on four sides of a big room, and it was 9 feet high, and it was about a foot deep. And then it had almost 18,000 vacuum tubes.
18,000 vacuum tubes is what you said?
That's right. Well, they created a lot of heat, so they had big fans at the bottom of each of the units blowing air up over the vacuum tubes to cool them. The ENIAC did 5,000 additions a second. It worked on 100 kilocycles. I mean, we have gigacycles of our little PCs. So the little PCs are 10,000 times faster than the ENIAC.
It's hard to imagine.
But at that time, the ENIAC was considered astounding.
Gene, tell me about the time when the ENIAC was going to be shown off to the press, and you were a part of the team that had to get it ready. Do you remember that?
Yes, it was the most exciting day of my life. 2 weeks before February 15th, 1946, when it was going to be introduced to the scientific community, Herman Goldstein invited Betty and me over to his apartment and asked if the trajectory was ready to go, if we could have it ready for the demonstration. So Betty and I, we were sure it was perfect, so we said, you bet. So he said, okay, you have the permission to do it, so hop to it. So we went back and began working on it like mad. And, of course, even though we thought it was perfect, I mean, it wasn't perfect in some areas. But in any case, we worked, and we could tell that everybody was pretty anxious that this worked, because they'd look pretty stupid introducing a machine to the scientific community, and it couldn't even do the problem it was bought for. So,
I mean, what would people see other than looking at the fans turning? Was there anything that the ENIAC did, any lights that blinked?
Or you don't see any fans turning. Those were hidden.
Okay, so what was there to see?
Well, the ENIAC had 20 accumulators, which were the adders of the machine. So each accumulator was 2 feet wide and 9 feet high, and at the top of it, there was a 10 by 10 matrix of the number that it could store. Each column could store a number 0 to 9.
Right.
So when the vacuum tubes that did the calculation for the ENIAC, the tips of them, they had drilled holes in the chassis in the front of them, so the tips of the vacuum tubes that actually did the calculations peeked through those holes. So it didn't show up very well, particularly when they took pictures. So Press Eckert and John Mockley and the engineers took bulbs that looked like half of ping pong balls and screwed them in the front of these vacuum tubes, and then they painted the numbers on them. So now you really had a spectacular demonstration, because when the numbers were built up, they really flashed. And you could see, you know, when the altitude was going up till it reached the peak, and then it would come back down, and when it hit the ground, and all this kind of stuff.
So was the day a success, Gene?
Ugh, are you kidding? It was the most successful. Everybody was just astounded.
This is the first time. I need to try and get this straight in my head. This was like the coming out party for the computer that we know today. I mean, isn't that pretty well accurate?
Yeah, well, it was the first. There's all kinds of arguments, you know, but the first electronic computer that really captured the imagination of everybody, and people came from all over the world to see it. I understand that Russia tried to order two of them.
Well, was there a celebration afterwards?
Well, not with me. The men all went out for dinner, but Betty and I were left. We were absolutely horrified. We were amazed because everybody ignored us.
The two of you had programmed this computer.
That's right.
I got the impression, listening to you, that men and women had been working side by side as equals on this thing.
Well, nobody was a programmer except the women and the engineers.
I want to try and be clear.
Well, no, wait a minute. I want to tell you about engineers. They like to design the good things and the exciting things, and then if somebody will do for them what they don't want to do themselves, and that's debugging something they've designed, they are delighted. So from the very beginning, the engineers were very supportive of us because
they needed you.
We prevented, you know, we did something that they didn't want to do for themselves.
But help me understand this in terms of the computers that we know today. Would it be fair to say, Gene, that for the ENIAC, that the women were the programmers, the women were in charge of the software, and the men, the engineers, were in charge of the hardware?
That's true. And for many years, the hardware was a lot more important than the software.
So the night of the big unveiling to the scientific community, all the engineers go off to a celebration and they leave the women behind. I find that unbelievable, given the fact that you had worked so closely with them up until that point.
Well, it happened. That's all I can say. And Betty and I were devastated because we knew how hard we'd worked, and we did realize how important what we did was.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Gene Bartik was one of the programmers for one of the world's first computers. Gene points out that Professor Mockley and Press Eckert and a number of the men she worked with were great mentors who did treat the women with respect. Gene says her work on the ENIAC gave her a lot of confidence, maybe too much confidence. At least she thinks her time there might have made things harder for her later on in her career.
I don't know what they teach in business school, but I'm convinced that one of the subjects they teach is never bring bad news to your CEO. Because I worked for three companies where they surrounded themselves with people and nobody ever told them the truth, particularly when it involved bad news. When I worked for Honeywell, the president was trying to get at the truth of how Honeywell products were doing, and he set up a whole competitive analysis group, and I was manager for many computers. And when we were hired, we were told that our most important job would be to have a meeting with the president, the CEO, and tell him how their products fit in the marketplace. And then when we had the meeting, he was surrounded by all of these people, and they just hustled him out, and he kept saying, I want to ask some questions, but they just dragged him out. Well, I knew very well one of them that was, in fact, and this is the guy that said to me, you'll never be vice president of any of these companies. He said, you're too aggressive, you're too open, and he said, the next generation of women that'll have more finesse will be the ones that will be made vice presidents of company, not people like you. And that certainly is true.
Which part of that is true, Gene, that you were too outspoken, or that's the way the business works?
that I told the truth. I felt that if I monkeyed around with my brain, I didn't have anything to sell. And I was punished at two different companies for telling the truth when nobody else would tell them.
You had a manager say to you at one point that, you know, the next generation of women programmers and engineers will have the business school finesse to make their way through the boardrooms. But that, you know, and there are women who've been very successful in senior management positions. We would both acknowledge that. But I wonder, in the time that you've spent talking to women programmers and women executives today, what are they saying now? Are they saying that there's a level playing field?
No, certainly not. I mean, a lot of the things that the women worry about is their own daughters, having a level playing field for their daughters.
And
I have one daughter. Now, she just told me this weekend, which I find surprising. She's in computer science, but she believes she should have been an engineer.
What's this daughter's name, Jean?
Jane Bartik.
And does Jane know that her mother's not too partial to engineers?
I married an engineer. Are you kidding? I'm crazy about engineers. I like anybody that does things.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Jean Bartik and the other women who programmed that early computer called the ENIAC are not unknown, but none of them gets much credit for the work they put in. I asked Jean if that bothers her.
No, I feel that I was just in the right place at the right time. I actually feel that I have gotten more accolades than I really deserve. It's interesting. My grandson went to Kalamazoo High School, and so one day the teacher brought a picture of the ENIAC in, and so my grandson Alex said, "That's my grandmom in the picture." So the teacher said, "Now, Alex, stop your exaggerating." So Alex said, "Well, that is my grandmom." I guess the teacher thought he was crazy because she called my son and said, "Alex got very upset in class today." And Tim said, "Well, it is his grandmother." So anyway, they were embarrassed enough that they invited me out to speak. So anyway, I gave this speech, and the girls are always much more impressed with me than the boys are. But there was this kid in the back of the room, and I had said that I was just in the right place at the right time. So this kid sat back and said, "Well, I guess you're getting more honors than you deserve if you were just in the right place at the right time." And so I said, "Yeah, you're right."
I don't know. Jean, I'm looking at that same photograph right now that has, I mean, it has you and you're standing against this great wall of wires and plugs and connectors and gauges. And I have to wonder what goes through your mind when you walk past a shop window today and you see these tiny little ThinkPad-type laptops that are big enough to slip into your purse, and you know that they're 10,000 times faster than what you were working on then. I mean,
I love it.
It's just such
I
a change,
love
though.
It.
Yeah.
Well, the miniaturization is what did it. I don't think anybody anticipated that. I mean, it's fabulous. Now, we thought about having terminals on a big system, but we never thought of having these tiny PCs. Well, I must say, let me tell you something that I'm very proud of. I went to school at Northwest Missouri State Teachers College, which is now Northwest Missouri University. And guess what? It's the first college in the United States that became an all-electronic campus. Can you believe that?
You know what cracks me up about it is that in 1946, you and the other women working at that time were trying to figure out ways of getting more memory into the ENIAC and making the thing run faster, which is exactly what people are doing with computers today, and nothing has changed.
Well, that's true. I mean, there are two different ways that you develop things, and one is the expanding puddle. You make things faster, better, do more things. And then you have the big splash theory, where something comes along that's totally different, that makes you think in a totally different way. Like Press and John thought of a commercial processor that could do sorting and merging and things like that. When they went to borrow money from the banks couldn't see how they could ever use a computer. So
I mean, and where would the banks be today without computers? Yeah.
Well,
you know, the other funny thing about this, Gene, is that back at the time when you math whizzes were programming ENIAC, probably very few people in this country had any idea the level that you were working at. But today, if you ask somebody what goes on inside a pocket calculator or a laptop computer, even fewer people know what goes on inside them, you know?
Well, that's true in the software. My goodness, I don't know. I mean, I love, I spend 5 or 6 hours a day on my computer. I mean, I even play bridge online, and I keep up with scads of people, and I read newspapers all over and everything like that.
Yeah, but do you ever
Google
go in and adjust
like
the programming?
A big library.
Do you ever open it up and adjust the programming a little bit if it's not?
No, I do not. I certainly do not, because I know I'm too ignorant. I could not possibly do anything. In fact, I don't do anything. I have my daughter when she comes, or I call up my son or my grandsons to ask them, how to do certain things. Plus, I read books.
Gene, it's been wonderful having you in the studio. Thanks so much for taking time to talk with me.
Well, thank you for talking to me.
Gene Bartik lives near Philadelphia. Special thanks today to Kathy Kleiman. She's making a documentary film about the role that women like Gene Bartik played in the early days of the computer age. And you can find some of the photographs we discussed and some links to read more about Gene and the ENIAC. It's all at our website at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. I've talked with a number of people here about their ideas for different ways to live a better life with less polluting and more thoughtful consuming, that sort of thing. My next guest is an inventor who specializes in things green. Patrick Ward says he spent many years dedicating himself to moving beyond a dependence on fossil fuels. His latest plan is to run his car on fuel made from algae and across the country doing it. Back when Patrick started thinking about the inequities of fuel consumption, it was the 1970s. He was working as a roadie for Merle Haggard. The Teamsters were on strike, complaining in part about fuel prices, and Patrick says it was dangerous to be on the road.
And there were truckers on overpasses with shotguns and rifles, you know, taking out scabs who were going to drive their trucks despite the Teamster strike. So we had to get a big banner on the front of the truck that said, Merle Haggard on tour, so they wouldn't shoot at us. That made an impression, because all truckers like Merle Haggard. It's pretty much a sure thing.
Don't shoot Merle or his stuff.
Well, you don't want to stop the show, you know. And so people would lay off of us, but we were skating on thin ice, and we knew it. Later, when the second Aramco oil embargo happened, we're out on tour again. We're trying to play this game where we find the one sweet spot with all the police cars and state troopers around it where you can get gas if you're a VIP, and we pull our trucks in there. And it made me feel real guilty that the average Joe was getting this raw deal. And it started to dawn on me at that point. I became aware that, you know, there's really something wrong with this picture. Why does only the VIPs get gas when it's scarce? Why don't we come up with a way to get off of dependency on foreign oil? And that there has to be a better way.
So you were thinking at the time when you went off the grid that it was a gesture of sort of reducing your dependence on fossil fuels. It wasn't that you wanted necessarily to produce your own electricity. Clearly, that would be a part of it. But this was about getting off fossil fuels.
Right. The thing that made the decision to get off fossil fuels was probably the hardest thing to do. And I took the easy thing first. I dealt with electricity because photovoltaics was fairly well developed even back then.
Yeah.
But after you get in a situation where you don't pay an electric bill, you have all the comforts and luxuries that anybody would expect from the grid. You don't have any of the downside. And somebody calls you up and says, why are your lights still on? The power's out. And you say, well, we don't get grid power. That's why. See, after that happens a few times, you realize you have no electric bill. You got all the luxuries you ever wanted. You don't want to go back.
Patrick Ward got more and more interested in alternative energy, and he was genuinely inspired one morning after reading a newspaper story. This article was raising questions about a thick blanket of foam that had mysteriously appeared, overnight, on the James River near Patrick's home.
It was like whipped cream, stiff. It built up the stiff, frothy foam, and it would just sit there for hours until the sun finally would start to attack the top surface and melt it.
And you had never seen this on the James River before?
Nor had the river keepers seen it or people in the park system seen it. They'd seen little hints of it before, but nothing like this immense scale of foaming activity.
Was it covering the river, or was it just sort of collecting
in
the eddies?
When I got there in the morning, it was almost bank to bank. There was a few spots where you could see water, but all through the rapids, there was these big, huge clumps of billowing foam. It's only 10 feet tall.
What did you think it was?
I was already on the search for organisms that would be energy-producing to make fuels, and I just had a hunch that, well, it's a long shot, but if this were a naturally occurring phenomenon, it would be extremely important to figure out what the organism is that's creating it.
But what were they saying in the newspaper? What were people saying this foam was?
It was being blamed on pollution, somebody dumped soap in the river, you know, all kinds of theories. They had a prison upstream. They blamed it on the laundry facility for a while. But nobody could really get to the bottom of it, and it was kind of like a phantom thing. It would come and go.
This notion that it was created by pollution, was this something that you bought into at all? Did you think that that was possible?
I thought it was possible, but the question was, what was the initial source of it? And when I located the lagoons and started to study them, I realized that even in a period of 6 weeks of drought, the quantity of oil in the oil slicks was getting thicker and thicker. And that pretty much ruled off all the runoff possibilities from parking lots, you know, cars leaking oil on the pavement or asphalt leaking oil.
Yeah.
So once we determined that it wasn't really coming from runoff, well, the only thing left at that point that made sense was some kind of organism living in those ponds that had found just the particular cascade of three niches and three different ponds that flowed into each other was causing some kind of natural phenomena that ended up making the foam.
So were you able to gather up some of this foam?
Got it in garbage bags, took it home and froze it, and then shattered the foam.
Wait a second. You put the garbage bags in the freezer?
Put the garbage bags in the freezer, just to reduce the volume, get the air out of it, shattered the foam. That left the little shards of ice crystals that contained whatever the foam
was. Yeah,
what
did it look like? Did it look like snow at this point, or was it darker?
It looked pretty much like snow or frost, yeah.
Yeah.
So then I put that in the microwave oven and boiled the water away. When I boiled the water away, on the bottom of the plate was a stain that looked kind of brownish, and I scraped it up with a razor blade, took a steel pin and put a little bit on the point of the pin and held a butane lighter under it, and it flashed and burned ferociously. Said, okay, now the James River is burning. It's producing something that burns the foams. You know?
This was something of a revelation at this point, I would think, right?
And I continued to monitor throughout the drought and assured myself that this stuff is actually growing right here in this pond, you know, and it's leaving a bigger oil slick every time I come to look at it. And then finally we had another rain event, and it washed all that down into the river, through all the lagoons and down into the river, and over the next couple of days the river foamed again. And finally it dawned on me, you know, the long shot I was hoping for was real. And so I went back to the lagoon and started gathering samples of all the various life forms, and principally the algae, because I knew there was algae at work here. I could see them growing. And I put about five different species together and grew them each separately in a separate photobioreactor. It was a lot of washing and careful separation of some of the filamentary algae from the diatoms and the other pico algae until I finally had them all growing separately. And on one of the photobioreactors, I was getting an oil slick.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Patrick Ward knows his science. To get close to the kind of biofuel he was searching for, he says you have to get the starches from a plant. And in the same way that he watched it happening on the river, you have to feed that starch to a certain bacteria.
And this bacteria has unique properties in that it eats algae or oils or starches from different crops and turn it into a biogasoline that will go directly into your car. It eats the feedstock, and it poops the biogasoline.
And that's what you were scooping up on the razor blade and the head of the pin, right?
Well, and then later, when I had it growing in the bioreactor, I scooped up that oil, and it looked, behaved, acted the same way, looked the same. For all practical purposes, is the same. And I was able to make biodiesel from enough of it, which amounted to a couple ounces, just barely enough to run a very small diesel engine to prime the pump and prove that it worked as a fuel.
Yeah, what was the quality of the fuel? Was it clean? Did it burn well, or was it kind of gunky?
It was actually very, very close to C16 carbet-length chains of oils, which is about perfect for diesel engines. And in fact, almost all the oil that we've ever used on Earth has come from some sort of algae that lived long ago and got laid down in layers, sedimentary layers under the ocean.
Right.
And that's why many of the oil finds are offshore. So what we're trying to do here is condense that 300-million-year process down into a process that takes 3 weeks. It takes 3 weeks because of drying times for getting water out of the product, and to keep the energy input low, we do things slower than we might otherwise do. So what we have set up for our own constraints is that any fuel we're going to make, we're going to make it from solar energy inputs and exclude fossil fuel energy inputs. So the fuels that we get as an end product are truly free of the petroleum cycle. There's no petroleum in it or used to make it.
Okay. Give me a sense of scale here now. If you were producing this oil in your basement, how long would it take? How much equipment would you make to make a cup or a gallon of this stuff? Is it within reach at this point?
Oh, it took me about 3 months to make the first 8 ounces or so. After that, I got to the point where I can make about 2 gallons a month. But I'm doing everything wrong. I'm doing things in a batch process. It's not a sterile, continuous system. I have to tear everything down and re-sterilize it between batches, you know, to avoid contamination with invader species or organisms. I'm not trying to make a record race for how fast I can make it. I'm just letting the LJ kind of and the diatoms kind of decide how fast. When they make enough, when I have a total of 66 gallons, then I'm going to leave for San Diego from New York. But I'm going to have to carry all the fuel on board. There's going to be 10 gallons in the tank and 56 gallons in the back and in gas cans.
Wait a second. Are you telling me that 65 gallons of this are going to get you across the country?
Yeah, in a Geo Metro that gets 58 miles to the gallon.
Have you already converted this car?
I don't have to do any conversions. It's a stock car.
Okay. And you've tried this fuel?
I've tried it on short runs. I don't have enough of it to make the run yet, so I didn't want to just, you know, go halfway and then run out. But I have done some small spot tests where I burned about a gallon on two different occasions.
And it runs well?
I think it was June 28th of 2006. We went over the Continental Divide, Loveland Pass in Colorado, at 10,200 feet, I believe. And that's the highest tunnel in any interstate system in the world.
This is important because if the engine is functioning well at that kind of an altitude, then you know that you've really got something that works, right?
Right. That was my concern. When I was going to high altitude with the stoichiometry, which is a chemistry term for the exact mix ratio of the air to fuel, is that going to be right?
Yeah.
When half the air isn't there, it's below you. You know, it's not available to cool your engine either, by the way. So the radiator is less efficient. You're working harder going up the steepest slopes on the interstate highway system in the United States. You got to cool the car, and you have enough combustion air. So those were all critical considerations about whether this would be altitude limited as a fuel, but it turns out it ran fine.
I want to go back to the manufacture of the fuel itself, Patrick. I mean, you say that, you know, you don't have all the hardware and the facilities necessary to produce it at any significant volume, but because you're doing it, you know what it takes. Is it possible? I mean, could someone do this in a factory and do it at any kind of economic scale? Or are we still years away from that?
There's big gaps in our knowledge. There's maybe 2 million species of algae out there, maybe 20 million. We don't know. Algae has a lot of potential in that you can grow 120 crops a year. In other words, 3 days is the growth cycle for a crop of algae. It doesn't spend all the solar photosynthetic energy building stalks and leaves and cellulose to hold itself up. It's just floating in the water. And so it's the most efficient producer of energy in the entire plant kingdom.
Tell me about your Geo Metro. If I was driving behind you on the highway, would I notice anything different about the performance of this little car?
Yeah, I'd be passing you.
There's a little pickup, is there, even with this stuff?
This stuff is better than gasoline. Is just a constellation of all these leftover petrochemicals that they had at the local refinery, and they vary the mix. And it's not gasoline is not a single fuel. This is a fuel that directly replaces gasoline, but is far superior to gasoline, just like biodiesel is far superior to petroleum diesel. It's a pure product.
You're listening to The Story from American Public Media. I'm Dick Gordon. Patrick Ward is an inventor who hopes to take this new biofuel and run his car across the country. He told me, though, that he won't put a big sign on that car or make a big fuss about the trip. He says it's still kind of illegal to use homemade fuel because people who do that aren't paying their share of taxes.
Can we please get a bill that says, if you're making your own fuel, you're exempt from the fuel taxes because it's in the national security interest that you do that. And when 30 or 35, maybe 40% of all America is making their own fuel, at that point we'll take another look in interest of equity. Figure out how to get those other 60% up to speed.
I read somewhere that you're planning on driving west on this homemade fuel, but driving back using cheese.
When you make cheese, you squeeze a liquid out through a cheesecloth, and that liquid is called liquid whey, and you have to pay to dry it. It takes a lot of propane to dry the cheese whey, so they end up having a negative value. They can't flush it down sewer systems because it affects the bacteria in the sewage treatment plant, and they get fined for that. So they have to pay to have it dried. It has a negative value of about 12 cents a pound.
Well, what would you do with this whey?
I'd leave it liquid form and not dry it, not waste the energy drying it. Instead, feed it to an anaerobic tank on the trailer, which will digest that and make the biobutanol as I drive. And a little hose leads to a nipple on the gas tank, and I drive along. And as I'm driving from cheese farm to cheese farm, as long as I keep filling the tank and giving nice cheese milk nutrient to the anaerobes, they'll happily poop biogasoline and obey Frito's law. We'll make more.
Now, is this just fantasy, or has this been done
anywhere?
Well,
so far, yeah. But I sure want to do it.
Fuel from algae, fuel from cheese whey. Now, I can be persuaded by Patrick Ward's enthusiasm, but let's face it, it wasn't too long ago when people were making fun of ideas like this. So I asked Patrick, with gas now over $3 a gallon and the planet overheating, is this finally his time?
I'm not looking at it as my time or biogasoline's time, because biogasoline's time, truthfully, is probably about 5 or 6 years away before we'll be able to make enough of it to actually make it serious dent in our energy consumption. But it could be 20 years away or 30 years away before it displaces the petroleum industry and stops making the chemical industry the petrochemical industry. It'll become the chemical industry again.
For a long, long time, though, people would say, what's the point? You know, gas is cheap. Why should we bother? Why is this guy, you know, wasting his time doing this sort of thing? And it seems to me that things have finally turned, or that they're turning. You must see it the same way.
Frankly, the thing that bothers me the most is that the oil companies are playing this really cleverly. They're dropping the price and then raising it again and dropping. They're giving us the gradual sawtooth, but gradually on the up curve price structure. And because of that, it's really hard for the small fryers trying to get started in the biofuels industry to know whether they can have a product that they can sell at a profit.
So, Patrick, when do you plan to leave?
Probably in the spring. Should be about April, May.
Can we check in with you from the road?
I would love to have you guys. I'm looking for reporters to follow behind me and make sure I don't fill up somewhere.
I trust you.
You can't buy the biobutanol anywhere.
All right, well,
you're
safe travels.
Come and watch.
Safe travels. We will stay in touch.
Yeah, thank you for the interview.
Thanks, Patrick.
Bye, Dick.
If you want a more detailed look inside Patrick Ward's pursuit of biofuel, we have a link to his website at our website, and you can find it all at thestory.org. Tomorrow on The Story, I'll talk with a young man who was born in Darfur, a man who worked there as an interpreter for the NGOs and the peacekeepers, and who's now studying in the U.S. His name is Al Banan. He says he'll never forget meeting a man who told the aid workers he was with that he had killed his own daughter.
She was raped by several people, and he discovered that she's pregnant. Because according to the Islam, it's not allowed for a girl to be pregnant or to do sex before marriage. So when he decided to kill her because it's a kind of revenge, he don't want to leave her and she's pregnant and the baby is going to be an illegal baby and he don't want to keep an illegal baby with him. So he's killed his daughter.
Stories from Darfur. And the story of how hard it's been for Al Banan to adjust to life as a college student in the U.S. That's tomorrow on The Story. If you have some thoughts about what you're hearing on the program or some suggestions of people, stories we ought to be looking at, You can get them all to me by sending me a letter. You can mail it to The Story at 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. That's 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. The zip code is 27517. You can leave me a message on our phone at 1-888-966-9862, or just send me a note via our website at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.